This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, we have a great show ahead for you here. We have an old friend to the Old Dogs Network here, and you'll know the second I say his name. His name is Neil Bawa. He has been on for years. He has been on in different capacities, talk to us about technology and multifamily investing. And the last time we had him on here was February 3rd, and he gave us the 2020 market outlook. And we were all excited about all the wonderful things ahead for 2020. And the following month, I guess we all know what happened. We got hit with the coronavirus. It changed things dramatically. Well, Neil is going to share today, but first I'm going to read a bio for those of you that may not know Neil. He's going to share with us today about how to invest in this new economy. But Neil, he brings extremely strong strategic and operational experience to his role as CEO of GrowCapitus Investments. Neil sources, negotiates, and acquires commercial properties across the U.S. for 500-plus investors. Current portfolio, over 2,000 units slash beds, projected to be 3,000 in 12 months. The portfolio, again, that'll probably be updated here. The portfolio includes multifamily and student housing properties in 9 U.S. states. Neil is a nationally recognized and an in-demand speaker at multifamily events, IRA events, and meetups across the country. Nearly 4,000 students attend his multifamily seminar series each year, and hundreds attend his Magic of Multifamily boot camps. Neil's nationwide meetup network, Multifamily University, has thousands of members. Neil leads GrowCapitus Investments, where he is driving the syndication and acquisition of multifamily properties. Well, Neil, welcome back to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back, Bill. I have a new title, though. I was the person most wrong in the world when it came to their 2020 forecast. So as you can imagine, all of the forecasting that I did for 2020 in Jan was completely decimated by COVID. And accidentally, some parts of it came true, but not in the way that I intended. So it was one of those, oh my God, I couldn't have been possibly more wrong. And now I have to kind of live with that forecast up there on the web. But such are black swan events.
Well, I think your intentions were good, and none of us would have anticipated that this pandemic would totally turn this entire globe upside down. And I mean, not in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine that something like this could just decimate a country. And but I'm here to listen to your I know you've had a lot of focus on this in the last months since March, and I'd really love to hear sort of your thoughts for those of us real estate investors here who are kind of looking at. I know there's a lot of us just waiting to see what happens in November, but at the same time, just how are we going to invest? What's the economy doing? What's it going to do? Again, another chance to make some projections here that we'd love to hear from your very talented and knowledgeable brain. So, Neil, take it.
Sounds good. Well, I've been getting this question about investing in a post-COVID world a lot, and I've divided my answer into sections, and the sections are what's changed, what hasn't changed, what cities are best to invest in a post-COVID world, and what asset classes are best to invest in a post-COVID world. So those are kind of
Oh,
four
that's a great
questions
areas.
that I get a lot. And so I always start out with what hasn't changed, right? So I'm going in reverse, and now I'll tell you why in a minute, and I think you'll see my logic there. What hasn't changed? What hasn't changed is, and this is especially great for older folks to hear, that what we've seen is that the banking authorities of the world, whether it's our US Fed, whether it is the European, federal banks, whether it's the Japanese federal banks, have reaffirmed their strategy remains the same, pretend and extend. And the way that they do that is that they basically follow the same exact playbook that they've been following since the 2008 recession, which is that whenever they see weakness in the economy, they cut interest rates. There are no dogmas anymore. There are no bottom barriers. Interest rates can be cut as low as needed to shore up the economy. We won't talk about whether that's artificial or a real shoring up of the economy, but what we can tell very easily is that they've continued their philosophy, and in fact, they've gotten bolder at it. So not only did the United States cut interest rates effectively to zero, the rest of the world cut rates to negative, but the US Fed recently announced that they are abandoning their policy of keeping inflation at 2%. This is a public announcement and is a huge announcement for real estate investors. Anyone that's investing in any kind of risk asset, whether it's Bitcoin or real estate or it's penny stocks, should pay careful attention because of my belief, and I've had this belief for years, that the real president of the United States is the chairman of the Fed. So Trump and Pence and Biden don't have the kind of impact today on real estate investing and on Main Street in particular that they used to have 20 or 30 years ago, because back then we had a Federal Reserve that was content to let the economy slide into a recession. They view their role as a body that would cushion the blow, that would make it a little bit softer. But today we have a Federal Reserve, and this is not just our Federal Reserve, but every one of the federal banks of the world, they believe that their role is an activist role to prevent any kind of recession from happening. And when they do that, they pervert the business cycle so that you basically have to follow what the Federal Reserve is doing today much more than what the Republican Party is doing or what the Democrat Party is doing. And there are exceptions to that rule. If the Democrats win both the presidency and the Senate, then a very large amount of change is possible, right? Last time this happened, Obamacare came out of it. This time it might actually come out of it. But I feel that the chances that they will win both the presidency and the Senate are extremely small, right? One or the other. And I don't think that much changes, because what we've seen is Republicans following Democrat policies and Democrats following Republican policies. For example, we've always, in my mind, I've always viewed the Republican Party as fiscal hawks, basically making sure that we don't overspend. And what I find is at the state level, they still are. If you look at Republican states throughout the union, they're better run. They balance their budget. When you look at Democrat states throughout the union, they're constantly overspending and going deeper and deeper into debt. But at a federal level, there is now no data-backed evidence that Republicans spend any less money than Democrats. In Feb 2020, we had a 3.8% unemployment rate. At some points, it was even at 3.5%. And we had trillion-dollar deficits, which were projected to increase over the next 5 years as the unemployment rate went up, which makes no sense. But it does if you understand that the two parties are merging in their views on the economy. The reason for that is because both parties recognize that it's the Fed that's driving the U.S. economy. And the Fed has one view, not two. The Fed is not a political body. They have a view on what they want to do with the economy when they want to drive it forward. So both parties are now beginning to conform to that view, which is money printing, low interest rates or negative interest rates. And it's not even our Fed that thinks that way. All of the federal bankers in the world think that way. So this is the big thing that hasn't changed, because in Feb, we were already cutting interest rates. Now, of course, we've dropped them all the way to zero. And you might, when I say all the way to zero, I mean that sarcastically. There is no end there, because after zero, there's -1, then there's -2, then there's -3, and so on and so forth. There's no limit to where banks will go, because everybody else is negative. So, there's no harm in the U.S. going negative at this point in time. So that policy of interest rates going down means that yields worldwide for all kinds of assets will go down, right? This is what we've seen. If Bill, in 1990, if Bill bought a treasury bond, he made 9% on that treasury bond. A U.S. treasury bond is a risk-free investment. It's the single least risky investment in the world, right? So in 1990, you were making 9%. Do you know what you were making on real estate in 1990? Bill, any guesses?
Gosh, 1990, I have no idea.
Okay, 11%. So there was only a 2% premium when Bill took a risk and bought a risk asset like real estate in 1990. So that gap, the risk premium, which defines the way that every investor behaves in the world, was very small. And then it went, it corrected. It went to about 4.5%, which is the most common risk premium gap between treasury bonds and what real estate makes. And so it stayed there. And then it dropped in 2005 to 200 points or 2%. And then, of course, we had the meltdown in the real estate market because there was no premium to risk in real estate. Real estate was truly extraordinarily expensive in 2005, 2006, 2007 onwards. And then it adjusted. By 2012, the premium had gone up to 5.5%, which means that real estate was really, really cheap. Because when you can make 5.5% more buying risk assets, you're much more likely to buy risk assets than to buy treasury bonds. But all along, treasury yields were dropping and dropping and dropping. So that 9% that Bill was getting in 1990, well, 30 years later, today, 10-year treasury bonds are 0.7%.
Oh, gee.
You've gone from 9 to 0.7. That means that yields for risk-free investments have dropped by 8.3% in 30 years. A catastrophically large number. As a result, the yields on real estate appear to be outsized. Today, we're recording this in September 2020, The yield gap between what real estate makes and what treasury bonds makes is an extraordinarily healthy 5.8%. And I can tell you, whenever that yield goes above 4.5%, people buy real estate. So I'm predicting a very significant increase in real estate prices over the next 3 to 5 years, especially because the Fed has now abandoned its policy of tightening. They've said that they will allow inflation to run above 2%. In the long run, which means interest rates stay low now, not for the next 2 or 3 years as we recover, but for the next 5 to 7 years and possibly longer than that. Also keep in mind that the U.S. government is running up such huge deficits that if we raise interest rates to, let's say, 5 or 6%, Well, then how will we pay back the interest on our massive federal debt? Almost 100% of what the government makes will actually just go towards payments on debt. No one will pay the military. No one will pay Social Security. No one will pay for the government itself. So there's a vested interest for government to keep interest rates down for an extended time frame and instead let inflation run hotter and fix the debt problem. Remember, you can always inflate your debt away by having higher inflation. We've been talking about this for 10 years, and now it's finally beginning to happen. The world banks are saying, you know what? We've got to let inflation run hotter. We were protecting our institutions from inflation. We're no longer going to do that. So the rule book is written, and it's massively in favor of real estate. Having said that, it's very normal for real estate to adjust downwards in a recession. And I do think that that's going to happen in some of the realms. And we can talk about which asset classes it's going to happen with. So what's really changed, you know, with COVID is that it has separated the different asset classes. From what we are seeing, the winner asset classes are single family, multifamily, and industrial. And I'll explain why for each of those. The loser asset classes are office, retail, and hotels. So it's created a winner and loser scenario where in the last 5 years, all of these asset classes were doing really well. But today, there's three not doing well at all, right? And it makes sense. And you might say, but Neil, this might only be temporary, right? I mean, everyone expects now that for there to be a vaccine in Q1 of next year, which means that travel could rebound by Q2, which means that hotels could rebound. Yes, except keep in mind that the wound that we have inflicted on the nation's hotel industry is so deep and so pervasive that it will take 3 to 4 years for hotels to recover. Travel took 2 years to recover after 9/11. This is a much deeper wound because 9/11 was an event that dominated headlines for about a month. COVID obviously has dominated headlines for, you know, 5.5, 6 months now. And I don't think this ends for another 6 months. So it's an incredible wound. Their balance sheets have been just decimated. The best hotels are still at the point where they have no money. And these are, I'm talking about the very best hotels in America, right? So it didn't just separate the wheat from the chaff. It turned all of the wheat to chaff when it came to hotels. So we're going to see bankruptcies in some of the most iconic hotels in America because hotels, as of today in September, are at 45% occupancy. Break-even is somewhere in the 60s. Some hotels break-even in the 70s. Wow. So that industry, I think, is very highly decimated. The retail industry, well, you know, I mean, not much has to be said there. If you didn't have a grocery store anchoring your retail area or mall, you're finished. And this one is permanent. Why? Well, it was coming anyway. For the last 10 years, people have been talking about the retail apocalypse. And everyone's been talking about it. The truth has been retail just hasn't grown, but it hasn't shrunk much in the last 10 years. It just has seen no growth, right? And they've retooled and changed things and, you know, they've revamped malls and shut some of the weaker ones down, but it hasn't been the apocalypse. Well, here's the news. This is the retail apocalypse. This is when we see a shrinkage in the retail industry in the United States, because I think they've done everything they possibly could already before COVID struck to restructure their operations. And here's what COVID did. In the United States in the last 5 years, e-commerce grows at 10 to 15% a year. Okay. And that doesn't sound very impressive until you realize that the US economy struggles to grow at 2% a year. So e-commerce was growing at 5 to 7 times the speed of the US economy. And then in 1 5-month time frame, e-commerce grew 5 times faster than it normally does, 77% year-over-year growth in an economy which is at 0% growth. Actually, it's at negative growth. But you see my point, right? It's growing at a ridiculous rate. We got 5 years of e-commerce growth in the United States in 1 5-month time frame. 5 years, right? And when you get that growth, some of it will come back because people do want to go out and go back to these retail outlets. So there'll be an easing and people will go out and you know, go back to the malls and do all of those sorts of things. But some of it is irreversible. Some portion of it is a change in attitudes. I'd only used DoorDash as a service 3 times in the last 3 years, usually when I was stuck in a hotel and didn't want to go out, right? I would, you know, call in DoorDash and they'd, you know, send something up to my room or to the hotel lobby. I used it about 50 times in the last 5 months. And older people didn't even know what the heck DoorDash was. And now they do. They know how to order food from their iPads. So that change is not, it's a one-way change, right? You've seen a huge change there. And because of that, I believe that retail in the U.S. could be permanently down by 5 to 10%. 5 to 10% is a huge reduction in demand in an industry that was zero growth or negative growth before COVID. So you're going to see a massive retail apocalypse in the U.S. in the next 2 to 3 years. And what's sad is retail is so expensive that you can't repurpose it. I hear people saying stuff that is truly not data-driven. It's truly nonsensical. People say, oh, nothing's going to happen to retail. They're going to repurpose it. And they're going to build apartments or industrial or you know, medical offices. No one has actually done the research to see if this is feasible. Retail is between $3 and $5 a square foot. Multifamily, $2 a square foot. Industrial, under $1 a square foot. Medical offices require very specific facilities. You can't just repurpose retail and turn it into medical offices. Most medical offices are built as medical offices because they have very specific construction requirements. So all this talk about repurposing is just uneducated nonsense. The truth is retail is the most expensive kind of real estate in the U.S., and it is going to suffer big time, Bill.
Wow, man, catastrophic in some areas. I mean, I think one of the things that really hit home is New York City. Mm-hmm. Yep. New York City, which I think it's, 70% of the income comes from the landlords that own the office buildings there.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, people are realizing that they can work remotely. I mean, what is that going to do to that city? I'm not, you know, let alone things like, you know, what I think 40% of the restaurants have closed down permanently.
Yep.
Devastated. And when the office buildings go and the people that are in those buildings, then all of the little stores that support those
exactly.
employees go. I mean, what's going to happen to those major cities that have, you know, that was the area everybody was going for in terms of real estate, right? You know, the millennials were all going downtown because they wanted to hang out there. They don't even have to get a car.
Right.
But that whole that whole modality has changed now, and
changed irreversibly, right? I mean, it's not something that's a short term change. So, you know, and by the way, I have plenty of good news to give you guys, but I want to start with these three, and then I'll move over to the winner side, right? So, the third loser, Bill, is office. And here's the surprising thing, right? So, if you're in office right now, you haven't done badly at all in the last 5 or 6 months, not at all. We have not seen much of a collections dip in office. We have not seen delinquencies. We haven't seen defaults. We haven't seen the kind of stress that's building up in hotels and retail. So a lot of people are saying, but Neil, why are you talking about office? Look at the collections. They're really good. My answer is, yes, that makes perfect sense. Because people, companies renting offices are much more capitalized than a barber that's basically just cutting hair for a living, right? So the retail folks, the moment they were shut down, they put up their hands and say, I can't pay rent. Companies don't do that because they have large buffers of cash. They don't want their rep in the marketplace, and they think that things will come back. So most companies have just paid up, and so offices have been okay. But more and more, we are seeing warnings from companies, large companies, mid-sized companies, saying when it's time for us to renew our lease, it's likely that we will shrink our space or simply not renew it. We had a $90 million lease that Pinterest didn't renew on a brand new office building in San Francisco a few weeks ago. That's an example. it's not the big companies I'm worried about. It's the mid-sized companies. A lot of mid-sized companies are retooling. We are seeing HR departments say, you know, they're publishing. This is actual news from last week. We're seeing HR departments say stuff like VMware said, you know, if you leave the San Francisco Bay Area to relocate, if you go to Denver, you'll get an 18% cut in salary. If you go to Los Angeles, you'll get an 8% cut in salary. If you go to New York, some other cheaper place, you'll get a 20% cut in salary. So they're actually giving you lists of cities that you move to and the salary cuts that you get. And people are still going to do it. Because to be honest, if you get an 18% cut to your San Francisco Bay Area salary when you do move to Denver, your quality of life just massively increased still because of what it costs to buy a four-bedroom home in Denver compared to buying it in downtown San Francisco. So we're seeing companies retool in a fundamental way. And the reason for that, there's only one real reason for it. And this is huge. This is massive. It's bigger than the retail apocalypse. It's bigger than the hotel apocalypse. And here it is. COVID trained tens of millions of CEOs everywhere in the world that they could run their companies remotely. They were forced to train that way. CEOs like going into the office because it strokes their massive egos, walking around amongst their people, having everyone wish them. I mean, that was a big deal for CEOs. So CEOs were the real reason why we couldn't live and work wherever we wanted, especially knowledge workers, right? People who work at a desk all day, people who answer phones. We could have worked from home in the last 10 years. The technology existed, but there was resistance from boards, from chairmen, from CEOs. And every one of those people has spent the last 5 months retooling their homes and building virtual offices, installing green screens, buying webcams, buying better microphones, and just getting better in general at living their life through technology. And the massive amount of infrastructure and money that you've spent in the last 5 months retooling, I don't think it's a temporary thing. So I think offices are the biggest loser, but I also think that they're the slowest loser. It's going to take 2, 3, 4 years for this world-changing impact of COVID to become obvious on the office sector.
Wow. Yeah. And that's what do you do with that piece of real estate? I mean, are you going to be able to retool that? I mean, what can you do with an office building besides it being an office building? I mean, retail isn't so great, so you don't go retail. You know, who's going to want to live in an office building? I mean, if there's no activity going on downtown, right?
I think the answer is it depends on the per square foot price. Offices tend to be in a very kind of diverse set of pricing, right? So you get offices at $1.25 a square foot, at $2 a 25 a square foot, $3, $4, $10 a square foot if you're in New York, right? Or San Francisco. So I think that the higher end offices, I have no clue what they're going to do with that space. I have no clue. I just think that the prices have to come down, right? And the lower end side, I think that there's room to retool. And the one area where I see significant opportunity in the next 10 years is in the retooling and you know, companies, if you're not able to do it yourself, you know, back companies that are going to take on office space, they're going to buy distressed office space and retool for medical office. Because office to medical office, much easier than retail to medical office. And I do believe that worldwide, we are going to see an increase in our healthcare spending. When you have a situation where for the first time in modern history, 7 billion people are focused on health, that also is a permanent shift. It's a shift for an entire generation. Maybe our kids will forget about COVID, but we won't. We will forget about this. We will remember this time when we were all afraid for our health. The whole world was afraid for health. So I think that this impacts healthcare spending permanently in a positive direction, which means that I think medical office space might see a significant upward shift. Having said that, I don't think that enough medical office space is needed. So I do think that offices will suffer, but at least there's some options for them to retool.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. I've also heard that some of the, you know, the big skyscraper type companies are looking at sort of regional types of office space in the suburbs, even.
Yes.
Sort of, yeah, suburban office spaces.
Yep. That is a very big trend, right? So when I'm looking at where are the opportunities for investors, so So one of the things is that we've been talking for years about, well, people moving to downtown, millennials moving to downtown. As always, the things that people say are usually out of date by 2 to 3 years. Starting 2017, the United States started to see a move away from downtowns. Occupancies in offices and multifamily buildings in downtown areas started to rise. To fall. Vacancies started to rise. And at the same time, we started seeing an increase in suburban office in terms of occupancy. We started seeing an increase in suburban multifamily in terms of occupancy. So people were leaving these increasingly expensive downtown areas and moving back to the suburbs. It was happening in 2017, 18, 19, 20. The CEO of Redfin has been talking about this in his various videos and offering numbers to support this. And so now we are seeing two kinds of moves. We're seeing moves away from super expensive places like San Francisco and New York. But the bigger move is that we are seeing moves away from downtowns back towards the suburbs. And it's not just multifamily. It's not just single family. It's office. So today, 5 months after COVID, suburban office vacancies are at an all-time low. And there's huge demand for de-densification on the office side. I don't know if it's consumers leaving and companies following them, or companies leaving and consumers following them. Who knows? Maybe it's a little bit of both. But it's very clear that we are about to see suburban as the new urban. Suburban, right?
So interesting.
Basically, in a small cluster of urban areas within suburban areas, cities that are building, smaller cities that are building downtowns is where the opportunity is. If you're a single family investor and you live in a city and they're doing an urban cluster, especially if they're doing it close to transportation, that is an incredible opportunity, because this is, in my mind, the first 6 months of a 30-year trend towards suburban.
Interesting. Wow. 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 We'll keep going here. I'm waiting for the real good news here.
Here's good news. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm done with the bad one, right? So we talked about the asset classes that are really suffering. The ones that are making money and are becoming really powerful, if you're an investor, you've got to look at industrial. When you have an asset class that in February, before COVID, if you ask 10 analysts, what is your favorite real estate asset classes, 7 out of 10 would say industrial. And what's amazing is most of the public didn't know this. But that was before we had 5 years of e-commerce growth in 5 months, right? Remember, every data center in the world is an industrial asset, right? And can you imagine the load that there has been on data centers in the last five months? I use Zoom, and I can't even record myself in high definition. They've shrunk me to like pre-DVD days in terms of recording, because their servers can't manage the load. So they've had to cut corners, right? I mean, demand for data centers, it is at an all-time. So people that are like, oh, e-commerce is done. Are you kidding me? It's still 1/10 of U.S. e-commerce. It has a very long way to go. I think that in 20 years, it could easily be at 20 to 30% of all U.S. transactions. As we learn more, you know, how to live with our phones, and there are new ways of, you know, buying online that we discover. So bottom line is, I think that the industrial asset class is huge, and not just for e-commerce reasons. There are populist measures all over the United States where both Republican and Democrat lawmakers are saying, we need to bring critical, you know, stuff back into the United States, critical manufacturing, right? You know, the gloves, the PPE, and of course, the toilet paper, which is most important. They want to bring all of that stuff back in. Even if 5% of these populist measures actually happen, wouldn't we need many billions of square feet of warehousing space? Because manufacturing is not done in offices, and offices are too expensive. So we'd have to build a huge amount of industrial warehousing space in the U.S. Also, we've gone from an economy, we were a JIT or just-in-time economy. The U.S. at any given point of time has 4 days of food. It has about a week of oil, those sorts of things. And now we've realized that just-in-time economies may not be the way to go. There are movements afoot to change that 4 days to more like 14 days. So we have 2 weeks of food and 2 weeks of oil and those sorts of things. Some of those will take hold. Some of them, you know, are just talk. But I think if that happens, once again, you need massive amount of storage space in this country. China is being basically painted as the big evil, and not just by the U.S. Please note that there are right now populist movements in India and the Philippines and in Brazil to paint China as the great evil place. And we are seeing that. We saw it this week when TikTok was forced to sell itself partially to Oracle, right? They tried to sell themselves to Microsoft and failed, and then they sold themselves to Oracle simply because Trump said, we're going to ban TikTok. And this is happening all over the world. People are finding China to be a convenient place to blame all of their COVID woes. And as that happens, the inevitable result is some portion of that manufacturing is going to return to the U.S., which now, believe it or not, is the most, the United States last year became once again the best place in the world to do industrial because of mechanization. I'm not saying this will bring back a lot of jobs. The jobs are gone. They're gone forever. But we do have the most awesome robots in the world, you know, and anyone going to a Tesla factory can see that. So if that manufacturing comes in, we don't need a lot of jobs, but we need a heck of a lot of space. So we see industrial as the big winner. And, you know, if you're out there, there's many ways to invest in industrial. There's REITs out there. There's, you know, stock market groups that focus on the industrial sector. We see them as the big winner. And then the second big winner is multifamily. I mean, in April, somebody asked me, what's your forecast of how much rent you'll collect in May? And I said, actually, that was in early April, and I was just beginning to collect rent. So my answer was for April. And I said, I think I might collect 80%. Well, I actually ended up collecting 94%. And in the last 5 months, multifamily collections have been phenomenal, right? I feel like I'm living in this dream world where my friends who are in retail and in hotel are living in this hell, this horror hell scenario that they can't even imagine. I have a friend who had restaurants here in San Francisco, and the guy was making $1 million a month. He's now losing $500,000 a month. He was making $1 million a month, right? Because from those restaurants. So there's people living in this hell that I'm not living in, because all I've had to do is to deal with, you know, outbreaks at my properties. I can't raise rents. I can't evict people. But overall, more than 95% of the revenue that was coming in Feb is still coming in. And yes, like everybody else, I'm afraid of what happens when unemployment runs out and those sorts of things. But I'm not as afraid as I was before, because number one, I'm seeing that the government is constantly taking up measures to prop up the U.S. economy. And number two, what I've seen is when people make any sort of money at all, they're spending it on food first, and then they're spending it on shelter. So what we've seen is literature coming out of the real estate industry saying, you know what? Things just changed. Need-based asset classes are going to gain. Investors are going to move money from want-based asset classes like hotel, like office, like retail, into need-based asset classes. And need-based asset classes today are multifamily and grocery-anchored store retail. So right now, another asset class that's incredibly hot is single-tenant grocery-anchored retail. Their prices are going through the roof. Demand is going through the roof because it's a need-based asset class. So from what we've seen, multifamily is a big winner, even though we're still nervous about what happens in the next 6 months because we can't evict tenants.
Right, right. And just a note on the industrial is, you know, that also could be a lifeline for a lot of the Rust Belt states, because if you know, you've driven through places like Ohio and Indianapolis, yep. And you know, there's these huge abandoned factories all over the place still, that you know, from all the companies that have exited there, that, you know, and they're at the crossroads of, you know, of the U.S. So they're in a great location, you know, to be able to supply to the entire, you know, North American continent. So yet I think there's some great opportunities there too for industrious people.
I think so, but I have a little caveat to that. You're right, of course, but what we're seeing is that those abandoned factories are actually getting picked up by places like Amazon, which need industrial warehouses, and factories can very easily be converted to industrial warehouses. But companies that are technologically advanced are going to newer cities that are higher educated because they want more technology. A perfect example is that Tesla very publicly negotiated with a Rust Belt state and with Austin at the same time, all the time implying that they were going to go to the Rust Belt state, but ended up building $1 billion factory in Austin.
Yeah,
Austin obviously is part of the new economy.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And it won out because it had the engineers at, you know, Texas State and all these other universities that Austin gathers. So what we're finding is that a lot of manufacturing is not going to California because it's too expensive. It's not going to New York, but it also doesn't seem to be going to the Rust Belt. It is going to Southeast hubs like Houston, which has, you know, a lot of good education levels, and the Texas Medical Center, which is the largest medical center on earth. It's going to Austin. It's going to Utah. Utah is seeing an incredible growth because Utahns are very highly educated compared to the rest of the U.S. So we're not seeing, unfortunately, we're seeing a continuation of a haves and have-not economy where places like Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, West Virginia, Illinois, Michigan continue to lose, though there's definitely some silver lining to some of these factories being repurposed by e-commerce, you know, folks. But I just don't know, you know, if it's going to even out for those places. So I'm still nervous about investing in the Midwest, though we are seeing some green shoots.
Right, right. What other areas do you see sort of optimistically here for the, you know, the short term and the long term?
Single family. So clearly a big winner is single family. We have already seen all the pundits talking about this single family housing crash, and there's going to be a big crash because there's going to be all these mortgages that will come to you and no one's paying their mortgage, blah, 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 for 5 months. And nationwide, 48 out of 50 markets are at all-time highs in September. 48 out of 50 are at all-time highs, both for price and for, you know, for lack of inventory. The inventory is lowest it has been for a very long time. Those and the two remaining markets, surprise, surprise, are the super expensive markets that people are running away from, San Francisco and New York. But everything else is really on fire at this time because when interest rates go from 4.5% to 3%, the amount of house that you can buy is so different. It's so different that it is motivating people that have been sitting on the sidelines for years to jump into the single family market. Also, our homes have all of a sudden become the key focus of our life because we live at home and now we work at home, right? And so people like me, I was telling you before this podcast started that I spent a huge amount of money rehabbing my home because I was at home for the next 6 months. And I realized that this wasn't something that was going to go away. That's kind of a nonsensical idea. As a scientist, I realized this is going to be with us for a year. So it's like, well, I'm just going to rehab my house and deal with the infection control issues in my house. A lot of people are doing that. You can't find lumber at Home Depots across the United States today. Why? Because we've never seen a wave of rehabbing like we are seeing today. This is well documented, so you can look at it. People are rehabbing their homes. They're adding extra rooms. They're converting guest rooms into offices. And all of these trends mean that that the price of single family will continue to increase. Yes, we're going to see evictions. Yes, we're going to see some foreclosures. But in any recession in history, there were evictions and foreclosures. It didn't substantially change the price of real estate. So, but what does substantially change the price of real estate is extraordinarily low interest rates. And we've already seen this effect happen. Lagging economies like Seattle, which had seen prices go down by as much as 9%, are up 6 or 7% in 5 months. Economies that were slowing down, such as Denver, which has seen a huge increase in the last 6 or 7 years, but was really slowing, have now sped up again. Even Orlando, which should be in big trouble right now, right? Because, I mean, it's Orlando, right? I mean, none of those Disney people are coming in. Their market is solid. Las Vegas, the only thing going for Las Vegas today is its single-family market. Rents are increasing in Las Vegas, even though roughly 25% of people in Vegas are out of work. So it is bizarre, but it's also very demonstrable that there is an enormous positive impact on the single family side.
Wow. Well, you also mentioned that there are some key markets. You touched on a couple here. What are the hot markets for this economy?
So the big thing that we saw is, you know, we track five key metrics when we look at, you know, which cities to invest in. It's population growth, job growth, income growth, home price growth, and crime reduction, right? These are the five metrics. But today, what we are telling everyone is only one of those metrics now matters for some amount of time. And that is job growth. The only metric that matters is job growth for at least for the next 12 months. So when we are looking at cities, we're looking at the ones that did not shut down. And this is, you know, this could get me in trouble from a political perspective, but the states that took a huge risk like Arizona and Utah and Idaho and didn't shut down are actually the real winners today. Arizona and Utah have the lowest unemployment rates in the U.S. Their economy is buzzing, absolutely buzzing. They're not taking as many of these, control measures. Many places, restaurants are open. Now, obviously, there's significant risk that these places are taking that they could have a super spreader case, or they could have a cluster that turns into a bigger problem. It could happen. But the way I see it in September, it's the states that have low unemployment rates that are winning. The ones that are loser states, unfortunately, all of California, very high unemployment rates, with Los Angeles being at the peak at about 20% unemployment. Boston has very high unemployment. Orlando and Vegas are still markets that are affected, so we're not looking to invest in them. But a lot of the others were really pre-COVID markets that came back very strong. So everything in Utah, everything in Idaho, North Carolina markets, we're seeing strong rebounds in Texan markets, Floridan markets, except for Miami, which had a very large tourism component. So the rest of Florida seems to have seen a very significant rebound. So the only true markets that we're not looking at anymore are the ones with very significant travel exposure. So that's Las Vegas, Reno, Atlantic City, Orlando, Miami, San Francisco. These are cities with a very large tourism component. So is Los Angeles, Anaheim. Those sorts of markets we're not looking at. But otherwise, it's the pre-COVID cities that were very strong appear to be the same cities that are strong post-COVID.
Interesting. And I think another key point, you mentioned how the states that didn't shut down also have surprisingly low, COVID exposure, which is, you think would have been affected because they didn't do a shutdown. But yet right at this point, they're fairly low on the scale.
Yeah, I have to say, I've done a lot of research and I haven't found out why. It seems that certain states that took a higher level of responsibility still ended up with a larger number of cases. So I think that when a decade from now, when we have all the data put together, I think there are going to be other factors that contributed to the spread or lack thereof that are not known yet, or at least they're not in the public domain yet. I think that there's other factors to this. Some of it is just chance. We've had super spreader events happen in places like New Orleans that just flattened the state. And other places, there weren't super spreader events.
Right, right. Yeah, I think, like you said, as time goes on, we'll be much more, I think, better informed as to what works in a pandemic and what doesn't, based on just the data that's out there that just has to be compiled at this point.
Yep.
Wow.
So that's kind of my kind of summary of, where we stand. I want to finish with one prediction. I think that over the next 30 years from now, people will consider COVID to have brought amazing benefits to the world. They will remember it as an event that killed a million people across the world, but they will also remember it as an event that fixed the world. The world was broken. 99% of real estate value was in 1% of the world's territory, even though we've had technology to work from anywhere for a long time. It's because the will wasn't there. The the political infrastructure didn't support it. The corporate infrastructure didn't support it. COVID will bring freedom to the world's workers. That's my belief. 30 years from now, they will see it as a keystone event that changed the world for the better.
Interesting. Well, it definitely shook us up. I know that. California, you and I both are in a state that definitely got shaken up. But it's interesting, you know, even in the housing market, I think we're going to see I just got off the phone talking to a guy about build to rent. He's in the build to rent space. And the homes that they're building are 4 and 5 bedroom homes. And, you know, most families don't really need that many, but you know that's the one of them is going to be an office. And I think also in the multifamily space, the apartments that are going to be most appealing are going to be the
larger ones.
Yeah. The larger ones, the 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments.
Well, we're scrambling to create these, you know, we have some that are already designed, so we can't go back and make more space. But we're redoing them to create these office nooks where no one can pass behind you because people are going to see you on Zoom, right?
So we're I like that.
Tiny little 6x6 rooms where no one's walking behind you. And so I think these nooks will become a big deal going forward because you can't really add bedrooms everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Now that's a really good idea. I mean, they've always had, you know, little desks built in type of things, but something like you said, where you don't, it literally is a room you can close off, and it also gives you better acoustics for Zoom calls and other things as well. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Well, Neil, this has been so just eye-opening, some great information here, and I think a lot of encouraging information as well. Yeah, there are some folks that maybe the worst is yet to come in some regards. After unemployment goes away or whatever it may be that is impacting people, but there is definitely a re-engineering of the economy and industry and you name it right across the board that we now I think you've just given us some key areas to look at not only geographically but different asset classes and other areas that we might want to dig in a little bit deeper on.
It's an interesting world and it's filled with opportunity. One message I have for people is that bad times have more opportunity than good times. This is the exact wrong time to freeze. Imagine transporting yourself back to 2008. Just get into your time machine, go back to 2008. There isn't a person listening to this that wouldn't buy everything, all real estate that they could find.
You got that right, yeah.
So remember that. Bad times have more opportunity. And I'm not just talking about real estate. I think there's opportunity in lots of different places. Right now is a great opportunity to buy distressed restaurants. Right now is a great opportunity to buy distressed hotels or inject equity into them because there was nothing really wrong with some of these. And keep in mind, if 40% of the restaurant industry goes out of business, well, the remaining 60% are going to do really, really well in a year from now.
Great point. Yeah, great point. Wow. Well, Neil, thank you. I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing a little bit of your expertise here. And like I said, I think there's more encouragement than otherwise in the presentation. So thank you for that.
Fantastic. And I'm doing a series of COVID impact on real estate town halls where we break this down. I'd like to invite your viewers or listeners to that. It's at multifamilyu.com. That's multifamily followed by the letter u.com. I believe that the next one that is coming in is actually the most controversial, and that is the impact of the election on real estate. So it's going to be the one we just did was the impact of COVID on student housing. We also did one on industrial. We did one on multifamily. We did one on single family. And then we were like, okay, let's take a break from COVID. So we're about to do one on the impact of the elections on real estate. So I'd love to invite your listeners to come listen to us on that one. We've got some interesting data to share with you.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think that's a hot topic. Do you know roughly when it'll air?
I think that's going to be about 2 weeks from now, and it'll be on our website. We'll leave it there for a week, and we'll do a town hall. We expect that our 500-user Zoom license will be consumed, so we'll give people a Facebook link just in case. Facebook doesn't have a limit.
Great, great. Yeah, we'll definitely put that on our on our show notes. And also, you're still doing the multifamily boot camps virtually, right?
We are. So we teach boot camps virtually, which I find to be the better way of teaching them than the 3-day kind of brain dump, which is more fun, but you end up learning less. So I actually enjoy teaching them virtually. I am teaching the boot camp right now. So I have 35 students taking the boot camp. And this is for people that want to become multifamily syndicators, learn how to raise money from other people to buy large multifamily assets. I think it's a phenomenal asset class, and it's always been a phenomenal asset class, but the last 5 months have turned it into a superstar asset class.
That's great. Well, definitely put links in to that as well. Wow. Well, this is good stuff, all good stuff here, Neil. And again, our appreciation here from on behalf of all our old dog listeners here. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me again. It's always a blast to be here.
Likewise. I also want to thank all our old dog listeners, too, for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Please note, everything Neil talked about will be outlined in detail in our show notes at the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/ blog, and you're going to look for the episode with Neil Bawa. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.